This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net.
This episode of the R.R. Campbell RightsCast is brought to you by Audible. Hey, there's a new year coming up, and if you're anything like me, one of your resolutions is to do more reading in 2020, and Audible can help with that. Maybe you want to listen to, say, Anne Garvin's I Like You Just Fine When You're Not Around, or The Dog Year. Well, you can start listening to either of them right now. Now, because Audible is offering RightsCast listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just head to audibletrial.com/RightsCast and download a title for free and start listening today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/RightsCast, WRITESCAST. Don't forget that S in the middle, audibletrial.com/RightsCast. All right, it's time to hop into today's episode. Roll the music. The release of this episode marks another year in the books, and in anticipation of bidding farewell to 2019 and looking forward to 2020, I thought I'd invite on a guest to reflect on the year that was. What lessons did we learn, and what can we take from our successes and our shortcomings? As our conversation evolved, however, it became apparent there was so much more to cover outside the bounds of your normal RightsCast Network year-end wrap, and so we let the conversation go where it may, covering topics ranging from what it means to relaunch one's career, how unexpected rejection can lead to a more nuanced understanding of oneself and one's work, and what it means to really know the market. Hey there, I'm author, writing coach, and RightsCast Network founder, R.R. Campbell, and welcome to episode 72 of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network. This episode's guest is USA Today best-selling author and founder of Tall Poppy Writers, Anne Garvin, PhD. Her books include I Like You Just Fine When You're Not Around, The Dog Year, and On Maggie's Watch. Anne writes funny and sad stories about women who have a good sense of humor about doing too much in a world that asks too much of them. She's a professor at University of Wisconsin Continuing Education and Drexel University, and she's held positions at Miami University and Southern New Hampshire in their Masters of Fine Arts programs. And as the founder of Tall Poppy Writers, she's committed to helping women writers succeed. You've heard me mention the Tall Poppies twice now in this introduction, and if you're curious to learn more about them, never fear. In the course of this interview, we touch on who they are, what they do, and what's made them such a successful organization. I have the pleasure of knowing Anne personally through our local writing community, and I'm really happy to have connected with her and to share our discussion with you now. So let's get right into it. Stay tuned after the interview for updates on what you can expect in 2020 from the RightsCast Network, and thanks, as always, for listening. Well, thank you very much, Anne Garvin, for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network.
Thank you so much for asking me to do this. I really appreciate it. This will be fun.
Yeah, I've been really looking forward to this conversation because this is, as I tend to do, listeners to this podcast know, we like to close out every year with a little bit of a retrospective and also a looking forward. It's a really original idea, don't you think? We're all about originality here.
Definitely an original
idea. Right. There's not a million programs already doing this, but hey, we're doing it for writers, right? We're doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for the writers. So let's roll with it right away here. And how did your 2019 go writing wise? What were some of the highlights for you?
Well, it was very roller coastery, I must say. So somewhere in there, I guess in between 2018 and maybe 17, 18, the beginning of 19, I wrote two books that I couldn't sell. And so those two books went into a drawer, and I had to, you know, I did something that I really looked hard about why those books didn't sell, what I was going to have to do to make a book that would sell, so that I could have this career that I like so much. And so I decided, I was like, well, this is crazy. I said, I think I need to go back to what I do very easily and what my people, if anybody, sort of expects anything from me. Maybe this is what they expect from me. And because the two books that I wrote were, one of them was a kind of a noisy mix of funny and sort of crazy. And I think it was too nutty for the market. And then I wrote definitely an Anne Garvin book that had a very strong domestic suspense thing in the middle of it. And is it funny? Is it scary? And even though there are definitely authors that do that, they were like, maybe somebody, you know, we want that from, but we don't really want that from you. So I had this sort of come to Jesus conversation with my agent, and I said, I'm going to write 5 book ideas for you. I'm going to write the pitches. I'm going to tell you exactly what those are going to be with a synopsis. I said, you number them, send it back to me. I will write them in that order. And that's what happened. And we sold that book on a preemptive sale on an outline.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Because if I would have had to write that 3rd book all the way through, that would have been 3 books with nothing in between. It would have driven me crazy. So it was very up and down.
I know that feeling. Right now, I've been doing a lot of balancing a few different projects. And I'm at the stage where, sure, I have my main sci-fi series and I can keep writing books toward that. But I've needed a break. But now I'm kind of out in this like void where, yeah, I know I'm working on these manuscripts, but will they sell? What are they right about? Are they brand aligned, so to speak? You know, my brand isn't Anne Garvin's brand. I have to figure out like what readers might want, if they want anything from me, you know? So it's a very precarious situation to find yourself in.
It really is. And I think I will sometimes hear people give new writers an advice, and they'll say something like, you know, don't write to the market, write what you want. And I think don't chase the market. You can't chase the market, but you do have to be aware of what's happening in the market. Like it's like, if all of a sudden, you know, vampires are big or something like that, you don't know if by the time you finish your book, if vampires are going to still be big. So it's probably not a good idea to be a non-vampire writer chasing a vampire. That's a bad idea. But you have to be aware of what the market is doing. Otherwise, you can easily do what I did, which is write 2 full books. Now, I think those books are enough of an Anne Garvin brand that I'll be able to edit them into something and they'll sell. But I don't know.
In the meantime, you've got this quote unquote 3rd book that you can really look forward to and know that there is some interest there, and that, of course, that one is going to work out. I'm curious to know, though, as you look back on having written those first 2 manuscripts, what was it that kind of drove you to dabble in a new angle of what Anne Garvin isn't considered to be in the market, so to speak? What made you want to write those books?
Okay, a couple of things. I'm going to talk about things that are a little bit uncomfortable for me to talk about. And one of them was, I write contemporary fiction, and often I'm described as women's fiction. And there is this pejorative thing that goes around being called women's fiction because there is no man's fiction. And so if you're going to put us into a category, if it's not going to be pejorative, then you better have a man's fiction, but there isn't any. And so I was teaching at an MFA, and the director of the MFA said to me, your book is not going to be a big book. Hmm. And the reason he said that was because he considered women's fiction lower in the hierarchy to other kinds of fiction. And then he fired me.
Oh, wow.
And there were a lot of reasons why happened. I don't think it had anything to do whether my book was going to be a big book or not, but I do think that there was an inherent kind of snobbery that was going on related to books that make money versus books that don't make. And when you're teaching in an MFA and your books make money, people don't like that very much. In some ways. I mean, that's a global statement that doesn't entirely work, but in some ways that is the case, because literary books are not often as big sellers, but they often can hide behind this idea that literary is the best and the rest of it is. And what I would always say to everyone is that those qualifications, the way that we describe things, whether it's genre work or sci-fi or YA or women's fiction or whatever, these are categorizations to be put on a bookshelf. They are not a hierarchy of what's best to worst. Unfortunately, though, it's not always felt that way. So I thought to myself, well, I actually started to feel pretty bad about my writing at that point. I thought, well, I just write crap. And so I started to write something a little bit more literary that is closer to what maybe Tom Perata would write. Which is close to my brand, but not quite. And then you know, the publishers and my agent were saying, this is more literary than what you usually write. Mm. It's going to be hard to relaunch you as that kind of writer. Mm. And so I said, well, I can turn this back into something that's solidly my brand. And then I thought, okay, I'll take a little break from this because it was kind of an involved book. And I thought, I'll rewrite it another time. And then I wrote a book that had this, it was just sort of accidentally, I wrote a book that had this domestic suspense piece in it because it just had this really great idea. And then I wrote it and then they were like, we like it. It's sort of an Anne Garvin book, but we don't know where it fits on the shelf. And that's misunderstanding the market. That's not really being entirely aware that there is no shelf that's like women's fiction, funny, domestic suspense.
And you raise a really good point here, talking about how it seems as though there might have been some interest in general for your one that was maybe more literary, but the concern that your publisher was having was that they didn't want to do this quote-unquote relaunch. And for listeners yep. who might not be familiar with that as a term or who might not know the industry quite as well, can you explain what that might have looked like yeah. if they had taken that
yes.
on?
Yes. So, you know, if you have fans, right, they've read your books, they've decided that they like your books, and they're hoping that your next book will be similar and different. A different story, but definitely the voice of this author that they like. And if the next book that you write surprises them in a way that doesn't work for them, then you might lose some of those people that you got in the first place that have been loyal readers. And so they'll say, well, we can relaunch you into a whole different area. So we're going to have to start finding new fans for you, and you're going to start sort of baseline now. And so this idea of relaunching, they would probably change your name. You know, they'd probably maybe I would go back to my Ming name or I'd pick a different name. And then people would say, okay, this is Anne Garvin, but she is now writing under Anne Wirtz, and she's writing this kind of book now. And that comes with a lot of interesting things, but it also comes with a lot of difficult things. And again, I keep kind of going back to this idea that you have to sort of understand the market, and the market being there's no place on the bookshelf for some of those books. And if they do find a place for it, then your fans need to find you again, or you got to get new fans. You would never think that were the case, but I guess, you know, in acting, I imagine it's the same way. Like, if Jennifer Aniston all of a sudden started to do, like, hero things, you'd be like, when is she going to fall in love or something? You would not really, you'd be waiting the whole time because you're sort of used to that kind of thing. And if she was going to rebrand herself into something entirely different, everybody would have to get on board. And a lot of people would be like, we don't like her like that, you know?
Right. And I think part of what you're getting at is this really interesting interplay between needing to know the market and what it is that readers are after, and also needing to know the industry, because I think it's pretty fair to say that publishers, especially some of the big five publishers, they tend to be pretty risk averse, I would say, yeah, at least based, you know, yeah. being someone on the outside, that really seems to be my impression. And so even if they know they have someone like you who has been a USA Today bestseller and you have this readership and you have shown that you have a great talent for interacting with folks and building up readership face to face and through your actual work, that is still, they're rolling the dice a little more than they might want to there. They really want to keep yeah. those dice in their pocket. And that's why it's important to, you know, be part of conversations like this, attend conferences, yes. et cetera, to know the industry and the market.
Yeah. You know, recently someone said to me, so what kind of books do you write? And like, who are you writing for, the market or you? And I was like, I'm doing both. And I know that some people think that's sort of a sellout, but I mean, you wouldn't make pants with three legs. How is that not selling to the market? Like, it's just, I don't want to write a book that no one would want to read. And I also would be nice if I could get another book and continue this career as an author. And the risk is you stop being an author. Now, you can do the things that, you know, like you can do self-publishing, or you can do hybrid publishing and those kinds of things. And that's all great. But if you don't have, like, I don't have those skills. Like, I don't really know that I'd have to learn all that again. So in the end, you don't ever have to totally give up your career, I guess. But if you have a certain trajectory and you want to stay in that trajectory, you better figure it out. But the truth of it is, for anyone self-published, not self-published, hybrid published, it doesn't matter. You still want readers. And if you're, you know, I think I kind of like, I'm happy with that little analogy. You wouldn't make pants with three legs.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, because I think to your point, there is this idea that if as an author, you get a feel for who your readers are, if you're fortunate enough to build up a readership that you understand and that understands you, if you start considering them while you write, that you are somehow selling out or you're betraying your craft or whatever the case might be. I think it all comes down to knowing what knowing what your intentions are, right? You know, yes. Do you want to be someone who is known as the person who created and sells three-legged pants and like that's your thing? Or do you want to be the person who sells nice, comfortable jeans and builds up something called Levi Strauss Company? It's all in what you're out there to do.
It's so true. Like, for example, I really did have to think about like, so who am I writing for? Am I writing so I don't get fired at the next MFA? Am I writing because I want to show this man that fired me before that I can write a book that hits the New York Times in, you know, in the review section or something? And like, what do I want? And, you know, I always say, I go back to my roots in writing. And I always say that with my books, I want people to feel understood and a little bit better about being human. So I want them to laugh a little bit at themselves. I want them to feel what humanity is like. I want to connect us in our collective humanness. And I can do that with my writing and my voice. If I decide to go into a more narrow thing, I reach less people. I get to less people to feel happy about being human. And so if I get back down to what I really like to do and what my point is for writing, that the way that I'm doing it now and the way that I'm moving forward, I get to write what I like best without hearing somebody else's voice in my head saying, that's not going to be a big book. Because at this point, my idea of a big book is a book that I got to write and I got readers to read, period.
And that's all you can ask for as an author, right? It's knowing that you were able to, as you say, it's your goal to tell stories that people can connect with and leave maybe feeling a little bit better about themselves. And if that's going to be part of the mission statement that you have for yourself as an author or for anyone as an author, there need to be people that are able to read those books. And that's where we come back to this idea of two-legged pants, folks. Let's stick with the two-legged pants.
Well, it's, you know, like you just said, mission statement. And, you know, if I, as a new writer, if somebody would have said to me, you need to write a mission statement, I would have scoffed. But actually, that is a great thing for someone to do. Now, I'm not even, if I had to sit down and think it out, I guess I would come up with what I just said, but I probably wouldn't have been able to do that as a new writer. But a mission statement is a good idea.
And the interesting thing, too, about this idea that if you had been asked what your mission statement is, it creates this sort of idea that it needs to be something really profound, right? Mm-hmm. But that you were able to just kind of speak to that as your truth, as who you are as a writer, I think that makes it even more authentic. And of course, if you're going to have a mission statement that is one that you can abide by as a creative, it needs to come from that moment of just abject creativity. It's that improvisation and that off-the-cuff feeling, I think.
You know, and I also think that to really decide what you want to do and be as a writer, I think you have to bump up against a lot of barriers, because each time you get one of those barriers, it narrows you closer and farther, you know, from and to the thing that you want to write. And so, like, if, you know, like I learned a lot by writing those two books. I learned specifically what I wanted and who I wanted to be. And also, somebody asked me recently, what do I think of what is success as a writer? And you have to decide that. And for me, success as a writer is living the writer's life, period. And what I think the writer's life is writing, talking about writing, getting to talk to you and doing these podcasts, thinking up stories, traveling and writing and talking to people and going to conferences. Like, that is what living the writing life to me is, because you can't always have a book coming out. There are times when things happen, take a break or whatever, and you can't feel unsuccessful during those times. So I think if you have a larger, broader idea of success, then you feel less failure on a daily basis. And as a writer, feeling failure on a daily basis, that is the best way to stop writing, because you lose your confidence.
And it's really refreshing to hear you say those exact words, that you can't always have a book coming out, because that has been a real personal and professional struggle for me this year, because as people who listen to this podcast might know, I had 3 books come out in a matter of 6 months, from November 2018 until April of 2019. And that created this really incredible whirlwind of like this idea of what it meant to be successful and what it meant to have books out in the world and to find readers and all everything that comes with that. And now here we are. It's November. I mean, my last book came out 6 months ago now, and I find myself day to day really struggling with this. What is success going to be to me? How does it feel now to be in a position where I'm looking back at 3 book launches that happened 1, 2, 3? They were all my first book launches. I didn't even have time to learn what worked and what didn't from one to the next. Yeah. And though at the time it was pitched to me as, this will be a really great way to get your career off the ground, this is going to be an excellent way to build readership. Well, what I have ultimately found, to be frank and to be very honest, both for you and for listeners, is that that did not happen at all.
Nope, it's hard.
It's very difficult, right? It's difficult to launch any one single book. When you're doing 3 books and 2 are in a series and 1 is a completely different, I mean, 1's contemporary fiction, 2 are in often the world of sci-fi. It is an extraordinary challenge, but to your point, there is something really wonderful about being in a position to live the writer's life. And that writer's life is about more than just having a book coming out. It's this conversation. Yeah. It's fun little engagement moments on Twitter. It's being able to send out a newsletter and knowing people identified with it when you hear back from them. So there are so many little things that I think it's important. We as writers, it sounds like you did this last year and I am actively trying to evaluate now, we find ways to take joy and take success in those little moments, because they are every bit as meaningful as getting a book out into the world, even if it might not seem like that on its face.
They are. And, you know, I think the other thing that people don't, my girlfriend, she has this, she was doing such a great job, and she was everywhere on Twitter and everywhere for the longest time. And I said, how can you do this? And she said, you can run really fast when you're being chased. But then she burned out. Yeah. And burnout is one of those things that is like insidiously dangerous for writers. You burn out on social media, you burn out on the promotion of it, and you burn out on the writing. And because you're so highly engaged all the time, which is not the way it was for writers forever, burnout can be a real problem. And you have to be able to figure out, okay, this is a marathon, if you want it to be a marathon. Now, certainly some people are like, I just want to get one book published and I'm going to be good and done and whatever. But if you want to do this for a longer term, you have to be ready for things to be going up and down and up and down. And you have to sort of fortify yourself for this burnout. The other thing I was going to say is, well, I like when you said, like I had to see what works and what doesn't work. And what I found is that nothing works.
Well, that's really reassuring. All of our listeners they're now off the air. They have stopped listening to the podcast and they've thrown everything out. But I suspect that you are speaking some truth to a metaphysical power here. So I really want to follow this.
I know. Well, and here's the thing. So there's a couple of things I'd like to clear up about that. Nothing works. So I would say nothing works, like not one thing works. Not one thing works. 10 years of one thing, that works. Okay, but you got 10 years of that one thing. Like you're constantly, it's like you, like I see you all over Twitter. You're so good at what you're doing. You're really good at, you know, this podcast and keeping readers and Twitter people interested and Instagram. But that is not just one thing you're doing. It's a lot of things that you have to do. Now, here's the other thing. And this is the part. This is going to make everyone feel bad, but it should make everyone feel good. And I'll tell you why. This is not bad news, even though it's going to sound bad. So I run the Tall Poppy Writers. I have 45 people at my disposal at any one moment, right? When we have a launch, that launch goes out to 500,000 people or more. And our Facebook posts of Tall Poppy Facebook, not the Bloom not the Bloom Facebook, but the other Tall Poppy Writers Facebook account. It's not a, it's a page, not our group. That on a regular basis gets up to 4.5 to 5 million views on one post. So that's how well we're doing. We can't move the needle on any one author's sales. Now, that's not to say we're not selling books. It's not to say that, you know, we aren't meeting people and getting lots of readers who are excited and fine. But if you need to move that needle, you have to sell a ton of books in one day for that needle to actually go in a direction. So if I can't move the needle with my 45 authors on my launch day, no one person can do it ever on any day, Tuesday, launch day, whatever. And so the reason that's good news is that you just fight the good fight and know that none of it's your fault. And while publishers would love you to take the responsibility, because they will say, well, you didn't sell very well, that you didn't sell very well is really insidious, because it doesn't have anything to do with you or what you did. It has a lot to do with how much money and time and effort they put into publishing your book. So I love traditional publishing because there's a lot of reasons that I love it. But I am well aware that whether my book does well or not doesn't really have much to do with me. It has to do with how well the book is written, if people like it when they read it, and if they tell their friends, and how much money a publisher will put into a book to get it in front of readers. But those publishers are not distributors. They're publishers. And so they don't have a lot of readership, access to readership. They're just putting money out there and hoping, just like, you know, like a Super Bowl commercial. So in the end, all you can do as one author is write the best book that you can write and hope people say, I just read this really good book.
There's nothing like that word of mouth. You know, we talk about how in an age of media saturation, whether it is with books, whether it is with podcasts, whether it is with your streaming, you know, service of choice, that how often do you have a friend who recommends something to you and you go, oh, yeah, I'll add it to my list. I'll add it to my list. But I feel like there is something different. There's something materially different about hearing from a friend that they have a book they want you to read. And I think that the difference is, there's probably a few differences, but I think one of them is that it's the difference between active media and passive media, right? If someone's going to recommend a book to you, they are saying it is worth your time to sit down and invest your attention and energy in something that won't just present itself to you. You have to participate in the process. And I think that that is a testament to why that word of mouth is so important. And I mean, there is a broader conversation to be had about how it is that you gin that up. And I think that's probably beyond the scope of this conversation. But I think to your point, you're very right. Just write the best book that you can, and then as powerless as it might feel to hear that it's all beyond your control and that there's this insidiousness of a publisher saying maybe you could have done or different. I know firsthand, and it has taken me months to really start to accept this and realize that, yes, there was only so much that I could do. And I did so much. And how much did it move the needle? So marginally, right? So focus on your work. If you're a listener to this podcast, focus on the writing, focus on the joy that it brings you, focus on your process and on the conversations, and then let everything else kind of fall in around you. At least that would be my advice anyway.
It is. And, you know, I had the opportunity to talk to a woman. Her name is Ann Beale, and she's a writer, but also she owns her own compass or her own company that does marketing kinds of things. And she has she's in charge of Lululemon, and she's in charge of some of these large, like McDonald's is one of her people. And she said the two things that people want is they want to feel something strong, and they want it to feel like it was for me. So for people like me. So when your friend says, this made me feel this way, and your friend is a people like me, those are the two things. And that's why people buy those books. And so if you can write a book that has this emotional component that makes people feel something, then those people like you are going to tell those people like them. and they can say, this, it made me feel this way. And so, and again, the only thing you have for that is to work on your craft so that you get people to feel the emotions that you want them to feel, because that's our job as writers, is to get people to feel things outside of what they would normally feel in an experience that they don't always get.
Right. Absolutely. And let's maybe transition a little bit here, because you mentioned tall poppy writers, and that is something that I know you're, of course, very intimately involved with. But many of my listeners, I suspect they might not have heard of it, despite its success and despite its scope. So why don't you take a moment and let listeners know what tall poppy writers is, first of all?
Sure. Yeah. We are the only cross-genre, female marketing-centered marketing cooperative in the world that we know of. Now there, and the thing that makes us so different is that we're female centered and also that we're cross genre. So we have all kinds of genres in it. Like there are marketing or people or collaboratives that work together within like historical or something like that, but we have it all. We run on the power. So we have several book. We have across social media, all of our, we are represented across social media. And what we do is we don't work with a budget. We work on the power of each and every individual poppy. And those poppies were brought in because of their generosity of spirit. So they do not compete with each other. We do not compete with each other. We work 100% to help each other find readers and get their voices in the world. When I was, my first book came out, I had pneumonia. It came out on the day that I went through my divorce. Like all these awful things happened all at once. And I thought, this is why people lose their voices at the side of the road. I didn't know anyone. I didn't know how to market. I had this book come out at a terrible time. And I thought, this is the way it is for women. We tend to do so much of the work within our homes. And we all have extra jobs and we're trying to write a book. How are we also going to market? And so when I started thinking about this, I thought, well, this is how we get silenced. That's crazy. I can't even have that. So I got a bunch of people together and we lose poppies and we get new poppies in and we train them. And the people, the authors that are part of our collaborative, they only do what their skills set is about. So we have lawyers, we have graphic designers, we have media people, we have website people, and luckily everybody is able to sort of embrace their skill to get this marketing business moving forward. We recently just won the Wisconsin Innovation Awards on two categories, which it was amazing to be nominated. There were 500 other businesses. They gave out 9 awards and we got 2.
Oh, wow.
So we got the Collaboration Innovation Award and we got the People's Choice Award. So, and that was really stunning because, as you know, when you're a writer, you're quietly writing and no one's paying any attention. Well, when you're marketing, you're not really supposed to be out there in front. You're supposed to be talking to your people. You're supposed to be developing relationships. So the fact that anyone noticed what we were doing was really exciting. So what we do really want to do is we elevate female voices everywhere. So even if you're not a tall poppy, we work really hard to bring you into our reader groups, our writer groups, and sort of spread the wealth a little bit. We do it as much as we can because there's 40 of them and I'm in charge and I'm not the most organized person, frankly, as you know.
You're great. No, you're great. I'm glad that we were able to connect. It's taken a couple months of back and forth to make it happen, but we finally made it work. So I'm glad we're here.
And so it's really been this amazing group of women. But it is a lot of work. It's like sometimes it can be a very hard thing to sort of organize and get moving. But it's exciting, and I know that I wouldn't have a sustained career with readers had I not done that. I had some tough years there. There were some lean years. It took me, I put 2 books into a shelf. I had 2 parents die. Like all these things sort of happened all at once. And if I didn't have the poppy still talking about each other and talking about books and my books, I'm afraid I would have slid off into oblivion.
Well, there's a couple things that I feel are worth mentioning on the back of all that. And the first is, of course, congratulations for those awards. I did see the releases and the information about that online. If you hadn't brought it up, I was certainly going to, because I thought that was really, really neat to see.
I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, I mean, of course you should be. I mean, this is something, and this ties into my second point, where you mentioned earlier that there are so many directions we can be pulled in. You know, you mentioned it's Twitter, it's Instagram, and we throw it in this category of social media, but they're all really their own thing. And if you're trying to do that, and you're trying to, I don't know, run a podcast network, and you're also trying to write books, and you're trying to teach at the UW, and you know that you've got a lot of these things going on as well. But with Tall Poppy Writers, this is really wonderful to hear, because it seems like this is, aside from your writing and the teaching that you do, Tall Poppy Writers is your thing. And then within Tall Poppy Writers, you are tailoring to people's strengths so that when they are contributing, they're contributing in that one best way they can. And it's really just it again ties back to this idea of having a mission statement or an ethos and then trying to build something around that. Because if you can always tether yourself to that truth, you can start to breed the kind of success you're after.
Yes. You know, when you try to white knuckle yourself into something else, you can do it for a little time, like a really short period of time. But if you want to have any sustainability, you cannot be the one that's white knuckling yourself into that. And I, you know, I've learned a lot about this. I'm not a business person. I'm a scientist. And so I had to learn quite a lot about, you know, what this was going to entail. And honestly, I just thought it was going to be this tiny little website with a couple of authors on it who talked about their stuff. I had no intention for it to be as big as it is. But, you know, I think what it does is mirror how much we need to help each other as authors. And I will say this, it's not a competitive game. It's a zero-sum game. Like, 10 of us could be on the New York Times at the same time. There's not only one mountaintop. And so, but writers are enormously competitive, and it's a waste of time. That is, sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down. That's always the way it's going to be. And somebody's going to be always better than you, and somebody's going to be a little bit worse than you. And so if anybody were to take anything away from what I was saying today, I would say, you know, just deal with yourself. You know, I don't read Publishers Marketplace. I don't read I read some of my reviews. I try really hard not to read too many reviews, because it makes me a little bit too self-focused, which I don't like. And then sometimes when they're terrible, it's painful.
Right. But, it's disheartening.
It's really awful for your self-esteem. But I try really hard not to read about what other people are doing, find out what their advances are, see what their money is. Are they going on book tour? I try really hard to stay away from that, because they're not going, well, Ann Garvin, if she does that, we're going to have to take $5,000 away from so-and-so. They're not doing that. They don't even know who I am. Nobody does. So it's like you write the best book that you can write. You be the most professional person that you can be, and you build relationships.
And how is it then, in an age where there is such an emphasis on authors getting on social media and trying to engage with readers, many of whom are not always going to be able to meet us face to face, how is it that you're able to kind of shut all of that out? Is there anything aside from not subscribing to Publishers Marketplace, for example, that you can do day to day that kind of helps you stay away from that?
One of the things I was thinking when you were asking, or were you going to ask that question, was like, how do you do it on a regular basis? And one of the things that I did was I made myself a brand. I am the brand. It's not my books. It's not the kind of book I write. It's Ann Garvin, the brand. So whatever goes in my books also could end up on Twitter or Facebook or any place. Like, I don't have to think, what about Ann? What would Ann the author do versus Ann the... So that's one thing. And I will say that probably I'm not a very competitive person in most cases. And so because... for some reason, competition takes all the energy out of me. And I think it's because I know that I'm not going to win. You know, so like, I don't want to know. Somebody's going to make more money than I am. And I also think that, and this is going to, maybe this is useful or not, but the feeling of that I get when I see someone doing better, the ugliness inside of that feeling is so so ugly, I prefer not to feel it. So the way that I stay away from that ugliness is I try not to engage in it. And I'll be like, you know, Anne, if you look at what their advance is, you're going to feel bad.
Right.
I don't like to feel bad.
Yeah.
So I just say, and it doesn't have anything to do with you. And it's not like you call your publisher and say, I want more. So I just try to ignore it and think, what do you really like? Well, I like to write my sentences. And I like it when a reader feels good about themselves. Well, does that have anything to do with that other person's advance? No. So stay the course. And I just give myself little talks. You know, that competition, unless you're an Olympic athlete, is just not a good thing for people. I don't think it makes us. And again, what it does is that competition is entirely against what the Tall Poppies is about, because we are trying to lift each other up and help each other. But if I'm competing with them, I'm not going to lift them up. So I can't even be in that headspace and still do what I want to do. And that's not to say that I don't get jealous sometimes.
I think it's one thing to look at another writer and like really fawn over, oh, if only I could get that kind of advance, or to be like angry about it. But I think there is something very human about seeing the success of someone else and being like, oh, dang, you know, that could have been me. Because there is something to be said for looking at that. And there's two paths that takes, right? There's the path of it stays and remains jealousy, where you just go, oh, woe is me. If only I could be like them. But then there's the other side of that coin, which is the, wow, very cool for them. I'm a little bummed it's not me, but this is now something that maybe I can aspire to. And as long as you're not doing it out of a sense of competition, but out of a sense of this general knowledge that other writers have had this kind of success, I know that if I'm true to my craft and true to myself, that could be me.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, it's like all of a sudden you're like, oh, you can fly? I can maybe fly. It shouldn't be like either or, you know, they get it and I don't. Instead, you know, and people have said to me before, you're so ambitious. And I think, am I ambitious? I'm like, interested is mostly. And since I get interested in something, then I want to do it better and better and better. And I find that if I spend a lot of time looking at other people and where they are in their career, I can't focus on where I am. And then I get all screwed up. Like I got very screwed up after I got fired from that MFA.
Well,
I got hired at two different MFAs afterwards, which definitely helped, because then I was like, see, you. But I will say it did screw me up for a while, especially when you come at writing a little bit different. Like, I wasn't always a writer. I came to it different. I sort of was self-taught. And so there's some of that imposter syndrome. So if somebody says, yes, in fact, you are an imposter, you are fired, you know, it can kind of mess with you a little bit. And so that's when I decided I was not going to engage in that kind of thing anymore. It just made me feel miserable.
And that's really smart. And I think we're, again, coming back to this idea. We talked about mission statements and having something to tether yourself to and trying to be honest in your work. And something you added in the last couple of minutes here was this idea that, how do you shut everything out? Well, part of it is just making sure that Anne Garvin, the author, is just Anne Garvin, the person. It's trying to make your brand just be you. And that is something that I have told myself in, I think, maybe not explicit ways, but every one of these year-end episodes, I say, okay, 2017 is going to be the year. 2018 is the year. 2019, 2020 is going to be the year where I finally just let my shoulders down and I take a deep breath and I'm just unabashedly honest about who I am and what I want and what I'm here to do. But there is this great fear that I know, at least in my case, holds me back, because it requires this degree of vulnerability that I think I personally haven't been ready to take on. And so though I'm feeling much more confident that 2020 will, quote, be the year, I wonder if there are other listeners out there who have felt this way, are feeling this way, or maybe they don't even realize they've been feeling this way. What is it that allowed you to sort of tap into that? Was there a conscious moment where you realized that's what you had to do, or was that just so ingrained in who you are that you were able to embrace it straight away?
I think there's a couple of that. I do want to say that I think that there was a pivotal moment. Well, let me just say, I think it was three things, right? I've always been pretty good at a lot of stuff, but not like the queen of the world of one thing. Like, I wasn't very fast as a runner. I was an okay flutist. I, you know, like, I'm okay, right? Like, I'm good at these things. And so I got kind of good at being marginal and okay with my, like, I'm pretty good at that, but I'm never going to be the best. And I actually think that that's not a terrible thing. Like, I think that that's not a terrible thing to me. And I sort of, even though I'd love to be able to say that I'm the best at something, that's never going to happen. Right now I'm at the best at lunch. Like, I'm super good at lunch. But, so that's one thing. I also think that, getting fired and it was a big thing, because I had to figure out how much I cared about that and how much that was going to affect me later going forward. I think, you know, and for a long time, let me just tell you, I didn't talk about getting fired, because I was so ashamed of it. And then I just decided, well, that's a dumb thing. Bring your shame out and set some light on it and see it. And what you end up hearing is all everybody else's getting fired story. So there's that. And then my parents died both, like, within 6 months apart. My father died in my arms. My mother died in my arms. I woke up and I was like, okay, I know what I'm doing now. And I think the compilation of all of those things helped me see that, you know, and this is going to sound so trite, but life is freaking short. It is really short. And it's also long. And if you're going to spend a long life in misery or competing, then that is going to be kind of miserable. And then you're going to die sooner than you think. And you're going to have been in the midst of this quagmire that doesn't make any sense at all. So I don't know if any of that is clear, but I guess what I would say is that I have pulled from all different places to get to the point where I sort of now understand who I want to be and who it is. And that's not to say that it isn't going to change. Like, the people that are listening right now, they could write a mission statement and be like, okay, now I'm going to add some, because I went through this. Now I think it's going to change a little bit. Like, I do think you need to write your mission statement that goes along with what's happening in your life. Like, it's not just a static mission statement, right?
Right.
Like, for example, like, I have a really good friend who's a good writer, and she can't get any writing done because she's got a kid, like a little baby. And I was like, your job right now is to be that kid's mom and write a paragraph every day. And then later, when that kid is a little bit older, you can write 2 pages. And then, you know, when that kid is a little bit older, you can write a book. But let's be honest, let's figure out what's really important to us and then write a mission statement and have it a living mission statement that lasts. And I think once you do that, you know, you spend a lot less time spinning your wheels and a lot more time moving forward.
And you wondered in there whether what it was you were saying was clear. And I can say that it was crystal clear, at least to me, because it really touched on a theme that is recurrent going back probably to episode 1. This is episode 72 of this podcast. Gosh. On the podcast network, right?
Congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. So we have 72 episodes, right, of this program. There's 20 some of novel approaches. There's a handful of biblio breakdown. And in all of these, I think there's something that is just one of the deepest truisms to the writing world. And that is that perseverance really does pay, right? If we're going to talk about looking at being a writer, and we're going to try and file, we're going to create some sort of dichotomy here, right? From things that you experienced that were very much less than ideal, that really made you question who you were as a person and what it is that you wanted. There were two paths, you know, diverging in the woods, if we're going to use that Robert Frost sort of analogy. And you have to kind of choose, well, is this the moment for me where I surrender to it all and that's just it? Or is this the moment where I take what I need from this moment? That's not to say you should push through and like write over your grief and all of that jazz. Yeah. You have to roll with the punches for a while and then you have to punch back, right? And if you never punch back, if you never take that shot, I think then you're kind of giving up on the best version of yourself. And when you do that, then you start doing what I've done for years on places like Twitter, where it's like, I have this presence that is a version of me, but it is not me. It's what I am in my newsletters is not me. What I have been in my fiction thus far that's been released, are like these tiny little slices of me, but they're not quite the me that I know is going to produce, maybe we'll say, the best work, or it's going to produce the most lasting engagements with people. And in taking lessons from adversity and then persevering, which is exactly what you described there in what I thought was very clear terms, that is where I think that additional level of joy comes from. And that's where we can really start to see progress for ourselves, both as individuals, as you know, in our personal lives and professionally, hopefully then as well.
Well, yeah, it's authenticity, isn't it? That's what you're talking about. It's that idea of authenticity and figuring it out. And also, it's the perfect story arc, right? It's like writer goes to write a book, decides that they don't know how to punctuate, learns to punctuate, and, you know, learns what it is, and gets pushed out, can't find an agent, does this, goes, gets this, you know, it's these, and then what you first started thinking was, I'm going to write a bestseller. And now you're like, I just want to finish it. But it's this, it's exactly the best storytelling arc. It's what makes it interesting to talk to writers and say, so how did you start doing this? And where did it go from there?
You know, Anne, if only there were someone who recently spent the last couple of months writing a few tens of thousands of words on that exact topic and framing a writer's journey as if it were the perfect story arc, I wonder, who is that person? What is the manuscript called? Will he be speaking about it at Right by the Lake in 2020? Probably. We can only hope. So more to come. But I mean, you've really nailed it on the head there. And that has been part of my journey to trying to be my more authentic self, is doing exactly what you describe. It's trying to view my own journey and my own relationship to my work through the lens of a story arc. And what I ultimately plan to do is interview other writers to add their insight to it, so we can see that this is so much a shared journey, that we don't need to have this sense of competition, that it's all going to be cyclical in the end. And we just need to make sure that we're able to identify the moments when we're down and know that it too can pass, and see the moments when we're up and go, this is great. But let's, you know, not, let's not rest on our laurels overly much. Let's celebrate, but let's not get complacent either. So it's just so great to hear coming from someone else and know that, wow, okay, so I didn't spend the last couple of months, you know, futilely typing out a thing that no one else might resonate with, for example.
Right, right. No, I know. And, you know, I think because we work so quietly and, you know, and that actually, you know, people complain, a lot of writers complain about social media, but I love Twitter. Like I'm not saying that I love all of
Twitter.
Twitter gets mad often, yes. Right? And when I don't ever want Twitter to get its evil eye on something I've said and decide that, you know, I am not fun anymore, because that would be hard, I think. But just in terms, like, here's what happened. Just the other day, this woman from London said, she reached out to me via email after I tweeted something. She laughed. She wrote me back on Twitter. Then she sent me an email and said, you should come to my house, which, you know, she was so nice. She wrote the best letter. We wrote back and forth. And I think probably I will stop by when I go to Europe this summer. But I never would have done that. You know, where would I ever meet that woman at any other time? Never. And so that's kind of what I like about that. I like to be able to reach out to other people and talk about these struggles and talk about how it's going and sort of join hands in this, because, boy, I don't think, except for acting, can you think of anything harder than writing?
Acting would be terribly hard. Yeah.
It'd be so hard. But writing, I'm sure it's almost the same in terms of, you know, trying to get parts, trying to get a publisher, trying to get book readers, trying to get people to watch. I bet it's very similar. But I can't think of much harder.
Right. No, I couldn't agree more. Guys, we as writers actually have the opportunity to, say, be our own editor. We're not performing in the moment and we're not being judged immediately. We can do a little bit of that hand waving before it gets to readers' eyes, and we can, you know, work with our beta readers, et cetera. Whereas if you're an actor, your audition is your audition. It doesn't matter if you did it really great right before you walked in the room. It's how you did it when you walked into the room. So, yes, point very well taken there. As we come up here on the end of the hour, we've had a lot of great chat about kind of 2019 and even before that, some lessons that we've learned. I want to know what it is that you are looking forward to in 2020 or 2020 and beyond.
So I sold the book and I am waiting for that. So that book is due in February, but it won't come out until April 1, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's kind of a long wait. They wanted it to come out right before the summer. It's kind of a summer road trip book. And I wouldn't be able to get it ready and done for this summer. So they put it on the docket for next summer. I'm hoping that I have, while I've been writing this book, I've been also creating another pitch to my agent of several other books that came up to me while I've been writing this. So my hope is that either I can sell one of the books that I've written that's in a drawer, or I will be able to sell the next one to them way before this next one comes out. So that, just because I would love to get, not necessarily, I don't know how long it would take me to write this next one, but I would love to get on a, I don't want to have to wait 4 more years for another book to come out. I will if I have to, but I'd rather not. So it, you know, my last book came out in 2016, so it's been a while. It feels really good to be back in the game, and I'm very happy to be back in the game. And I left my university position to write full time.
Oh, you did? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I left last, my last semester was September. No, May. It was May. I had the summer off. And then this September happened, and I didn't realize that I'd left my job until September hit. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't have any place to go. And that freaked me out a little bit, but I'm very excited that I did that. Like, it's a really fun thing to be able to do. So that's kind of what I'm looking forward to. I'm hoping to sell a few more books while we wait for the other one to come out. I'm glad to be back in the game. Being out of the game there for a while was stressful. So I'm really glad to be back in.
Well, you're glad to be back in the game, and we are glad to have you back in the game. I'm glad that you could join me for this episode on the podcast. So thank you very much, Anne. It was wonderful to have you here on the R.R. Campbell Rightscast here on the Rightscast Network.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
That's all for my interview of Anne Garvin, PhD. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you could leave the Rightscast Network a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. This will help the Rightscast Network reach more writers like you, and building that sense of community is what we, and I hope you, are all about. To those of you who have already left us a 5-star rating and review, thank you. And thank you again to Anne Garvin for joining us for this episode. I of course owe additional thanks to the Rightscast Network's patrons who contribute to our programming financially at patreon.com/rightscast. In exchange for their support, Rightscast Network patrons get access to some great patron perks, including Rightscast swag, discounts on my editing services, and entries in monthly drawings for partial manuscript critiques performed by yours truly. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can join patrons like Laura Hazen today in supporting our programming at a very generous $3 per episode. Or, if $3 per episode is more than you can afford, you can contribute at $1 or $2 per episode or per month as well, all of which will get you access to a number of our fantastic patron perks. So become a supporter today by making your pledge at patreon.com/rightscast. That's patreon.com/rightscast. Coming up next on the Rightscast Network is an episode featuring author M.D. New, who regular listeners might remember from episode 58 of the R.R. Campbell Rightscast, in which we discussed the ins and outs of growing your readership locally. MD's episode will be our first of 2020, available on January 3rd on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, Rightscast.net, and wherever you listen to podcasts. Until then, you can stay in touch with us by visiting Rightscast.net or by saying hello on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Rightscast, or by searching for the Rightscast Network. We're also available by email at rightscast@gmail.com. You can also now give us a call at area code 608-284-8342 and share any questions you might have for guests, suggestions you have for Novel Approaches episodes, or questions you want us to address in any of those Novel Approaches episodes. Again, that number is 608-284-8342. To reach me personally, you can visit rrcampbellwrites.com or holler at me on Twitter as @IamRRCampbell. I love hearing from listeners of all backgrounds, so please don't hesitate to reach out. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this is R.R. Campbell signing off. Write on and write well.
This is the Rightscast Network at rightscast.net.